This is F-Society IRC Podcast, a Mr. Robot show. I'm your moderator of this chat, Hirosha Shive. This is F-Society IRC Podcast, a Mr. Robot show. I'm your moderator of this chat, Hirosha Shive.
Hello, friends. This is Hirosha Shive of F-Society IRC Podcast, a Mr. Robot show. I'm the moderator of this chat, and this is our second review of our seven-part review series about films that have influenced the story of Mr. Robot, the television show. So the second most important movie, I would say, that has directly influenced the show has been The Minute So by Sam Esmail, is Fight Club. And we'll get into the reasons why Sam Esmail states that this the use of Fight Club, which is a very obvious influence when you see the character of Mr. Robot and you realize fairly early on, I would say probably most people caught on either immediately or by episode 3 that he wasn't really there. You know, the image of Edward Alderson and the personality that manifested out of Elliot, this Mr. Robot image, if you will, was a very kind of Tyler Durden-esque character. But before we get into all that, why it's such a heavy influence and why it was like a template or undertone of the, or at least the story, some of the story architecture from the Fight Club movie and a little bit from the book is in the television series Mr. Robot, let's talk about the film itself. So, Fight Club. Synopsis. An insomniac office worker looking for a way to change his life crosses paths with a devil-may-care soap maker, forming an underground fight club that evolves into something much, much more. It stars Brad Pitt as Tyler Durden, Edward Norton as Guy. His name is never given. He is the narrator. Helen Bohemian Carter as Marla Singer, and is directed by David Fincher. My take. Still know what people think it is. This film came out in 1999, which we will be talking about another film that came out in 1999, The Matrix, on our next review. In fact, I think 1999 is probably one of those seminal years in film. I think it's like 1939. I believe like we're Gone with the Wind and The Wizard of Oz and a bunch of big epic movies came out. It was like a year, like 1972 or 70-something, where like Godfather and a bunch of other films came out. It launched like the kind of new wave. You might say 1980, I think, with Empire Strikes Back and E.T., I think, or I'm not sure which other movies. But there's or maybe it might be 1983 with Blade Runner and Return of the Jedi and E.T. I think that's the year. But there's certain films that kind of change and shift the dynamic of the films for the next decade and kind of echo throughout the industry. I think 1991 or 92 is where the rise of the indie films, where you got like Clerks and Pulp Fiction affected a lot of the films in the 90s, including in some aspects Fight Club, things of that nature. So 1999 is a very important historical point in history as far as films go. And I actually did see this in the movie theaters. It's one of those films, you hear that a lot from film buffs, oh, you have to see it in the movies, it's the proper way to see it. This is actually one of those films that statement, if you will, makes sense. I think another film is like 2001 Space Odyssey and Fantasia, I would say, fits that bill. Avatar fits that bill. Like, you have to really see it in the movie theater to appreciate the full scope of the film. And the reason why you do is because of the certain film techniques that David Fincher utilizes to kind of hint to the audience the existence of Tyler Durden early on, little cuts and edits that you can't really, it doesn't transfer from film to DVD, it just doesn't exist. He flashes very briefly, which is explained in the movie itself by the narrator, by Edward Norton, talking about Tyler Durden's late night job as a projectionist and talking about how, you know, projectionists sometimes snip a little flashes of porn in kid movies and stuff like that, called smoke rings and all that. That monologue there gives a hint of how Tyler Durden was inserted in the film or inserted in Edward Norton's character's life. Saw it several times. Didn't quite get it at first, but I did really enjoy the film. And then I just kept seeing it and saw different aspects and saw what was being done with the film. It's a very much slept upon film at the time. It really didn't gain momentum until it hit the DVD and then everyone, or VHS, everyone was talking about it, the home movie theater market. And then Fight Club was everywhere. You still see the influences of Fight Club by references, music videos, actual fight clubs being formed by people. And this is where I get to the fact that people don't realize that Fight Club, which is something that David Fincher and Edward Norton, Brad Pitt, and even to some extent Helen Carter have talked about, that it's a satire. You're not supposed to take the things stated or shown in the film seriously, like the revolution, Operation Mayhem, the Fight Club, the hyper-sexualization and hyper-masculinity in the film is satire. It is making fun of these different genre tropes and aspects of male bonding and perceptions in society and how people think they can change their outlook through revolution or some kind of violent action, if you will. And I don't think people got the fact that it was a satire. I think some people saw it as a template, as a way of existing and being in life, and it just kind of went over their head for the most part. There are still things to this day, I just recently rewatched it and doing the research for this review, that I didn't even realize as far as often as I've seen the film and talked about the film, but certain little nuggets I wasn't aware of, like there's a Starbucks cup in every shot in the film. I wasn't aware of that. And when I became aware of that, you obviously see it just kind of like if someone tells you about, says, you know, red car, you know, you see red cars everywhere. It's in the forefront of your brain. So, but like, basically like many things in life, many people just basically saw the surface of Fight Club and took it, like I said, as a template on how to act and behave. And even how to take down, you know, the people in charge, the revolution that should occur. And I mean, you know, how many Fight Clubs were started after the film, you know, hit video market. You know, it kind of grew into the cultural zeitgeist over the last 19 years, soon to be 20, so... Why Samuel Smith states why he used Fight Club as an influence, the influence of David Fincher influenced him. There's a lot of significant filmmakers, and David Fincher is one of them, that has influenced the stylistic and even story aspects of Samuel's writing and directing. Is that the problem that many people have had with Fight Club, even with the book and the movie, which the book is, there's a little bit more detail, but it doesn't veer too much. They're, unlike some other books where there's significant changes or whatever, there's not that many changes from the book to the film. Basically the same essence is occurring here. You know, at the end of the film, the revolutionary moment takes place where the buildings are destroyed, and that's the end of the film. You see the buildings destroyed, you see our character, Edward Norton with Mara Singer in a skyrise building watching the destruction of other financial buildings being blown up by the Project Mayhem cohorts, his followers, if you will, after shooting himself in the face to get rid of Tyler Durden, the personality that he realizes controlling and that he created himself. Sam Mason wanted to talk about, which a lot of people wanted to talk about, like, what happens after the revolution? What happens after this? You just created a financial economic collapse. That's kind of shitty, if you think about it. You know, you just put everyone in the poorhouse. How is that revolutionary? That's very destructive. That's going to cause the collapse of civilization. It's going to cause the collapse of a lot of things. And so Sam Edison wanted to take that notion and run with it initially when he conceived Mr. Robot as a film to now the television series where you're seeing the aftermath of what happens, like the 5-9 hack, the decay of the city of New York, the slow decay, and then almost an accelerated pace when season 3 starts with E-coin coming into existence and being the more dominant currency versus the dollar, and see, you know, more businesses collapsing, trash everywhere. People are selling wares, selling goods. They're bartering. They're using Bitcoin, doing peer-to-peer transactions. They're burning trash and paying to burn trash because trash is not being picked up. They're selling food or giving away food. There's the soup kitchen lines, much similar to like the Depression, because that's what they're in. They're in an economic depression. And there is no real like significant change to everyone's existence. Everything's gone to crap. People are losing their homes. If they sell their homes, they're not getting the money that they should be getting out of it to move somewhere cheaper. We see that with Romero's mother, who wants to leave her home and go down to Florida, where it's a bit more cheaper for her. She's not going to get the return on her, I guess you could say, the investment, if you will. And so I think that's very important. You know, Sam Esmail states that, let's see, Josh H, who I want to make sure I get his Reddit name correct, goes by YipsFaxJ48. He was the Redditor that came up with a very early on prediction that 71 buildings, that was stage two, that there was going to be an explosion. He wasn't unsure, but he thinks it's very important because it's something that was on the map with Tyler Wellick. He goes into his whole theory, and it turns out he was correct, that he actually kind of predicted that event from happening. And if you look at the clues that he utilized in just, you know, rewatching those episodes, particularly from season two, there was clues to all the way to that very moment. You realize that it was very hinted in the fact that stage two was more than just that one building that Elliot was trying to save. It was the entire E-Corp paper record infrastructure, if you will. But he talks about, you know, I guess you can say during season two about his theory about Sam and Esmail and Fright Club. Let's see. So 1 year ago, I had a bunch of debates. I'm going to read a little bit from this post here, where I suggested that season one was not a flat-out homage to Fight Club, but more of a criticism of the end of Fight Club. My argument was that Ismail wanted Elliot to face the ethical consequences of collapsing the economy and not simply sit back and have a great time watching the buildings go down. And then he talks about how Ismail said this in Entertainment Weekly. The whole goal in the first half of the second season was to destroy and erase Mr. Robot. Series creator Sam Esmail says, again, in a weird way, I think it paralleled what we were trying to do with the 5-9 hack. He was trying to ignore it and erase it and pretend that he wasn't responsible for it. Now that's all come to pass. So this third season has Elliot facing that challenge. If you can't annihilate that thing that's broken inside of you, how can you heal the wound? What can you do about that? Yep, it's paralleled what he's trying to do with the 5-9 hack. He was trying to ignore it and erase it and pretend that he wasn't responsible for it. Mr. Robot is about the ethical responsibilities borne by all the players, including revolutionaries, corporations, sub-state actors, governments, and individuals. This also addresses the usual critique that Mr. Robot was just a rip-off of Fincher's Fight Club movie. And I very much agree with this. This is something that's been kind of debated for quite some time within, you know, the community of Mr. Robot. And I do believe, and I honestly believe with the season three, that Sam Esmail hammers the point of a repudiation to Fight Club. How it's extremely irresponsible, particularly with a lot of these films and books where they do these significant revolutionary acts, but they don't show the consequences of what happens when you have a revolution, when you do these very destructive acts to propel society, humanity forward. It's like breaking an egg. You have all this egg on the ground all over the place. Now what? Are you going to make scrambled eggs? Are you going to make sunny-side eggs? You can't put the egg back together, so you got to make something new. But we never see what that making something new is. And I think another point that's missing in some of the discussions about the influence of Mr. Robot is something that Sam Esmail said himself, that he was also inspired by the Arab Spring, particularly because of his heritage of what was going on in Egypt. And you see some of that aspects here with some of the techniques and tactics that the F Society uses, the propaganda and stuff like that with Anonymous and what it is they're seeking to do, the fact that it was a very small group trying to take on, you know, the band of, you know, little scrappy rebels taking on the big bad. In this case, it was, I think it's Mubarak's, the president's, that particular corrupt president taking that regime down. But what ends up happening, and what many commentators are saying at the time that the revolution was going to happen, was what happens after the removal of power, removing the big bad. You have this revolutionary moment. Now you have to build the new infrastructure. And what ended up happening is the revolutionaries end up getting pushed out because they're not as well organized as the big bad, in a sense. As Elliot pointed out when he was talking about to Darlene when the F Society was first formed, he said, even after we do the hack and encrypt the data, they're going to try to come back and be bigger and badder than they were before. So we need another plan to combat that. We have to keep hammering. And that's where this concept of stage two came in, where they were going to attack the paper records and really try to destroy Evil Corp. That, in a sense, is what was somewhat happened in Egypt, where first there was the Muslim Brotherhood and then eventually the military. And what you end up having was basically much of the same players that were in the previous Big Bad's regime have reformed and taken over, and now things are a bit much worse for many people within the Egyptian society. They had this revolutionary moment. They tried to make this great big change. In a sense, you could say that there was a bit of a Philip Price actor that allowed it to happen, in the sense of America. America could easily have stepped in and backed Mubarak, but they didn't. They, you know, Obama withheld his support, as well as other European countries, and saw the collapse of his particular government and the formation of this new one. You can kind of see the parallels to that in the story arcs of Mr. Robot, where you had F Society doing the 5-9 hack and encrypting those servers. Now you had this big, monstrous act of terrorism with the destruction of the paper records, all of them, basically, of the 71 buildings blowing up, which was, you know, again, going back to my previous review, was the hijacking of the F Society caused by White Rose, the Dark Army, the cult, for dark purposes, taking your concept and doing the most logical extent of it, the most darkest extent, if you were to really fully think out everything, which Elliot had done so, but he wasn't committed to do so because he didn't want people to die. Maybe he had a plan where all those buildings could have gone down, but without the people in them, but that's not what White Rose did. She made sure that people died. Because it fit her plan to get her to take out Philip Price for petty reasons, to shore up E-Corp, but I guess you could say under China control, having significant influence on the global market now as being the big bailout, so the $2 trillion bailout that allowed for the global economy to continue, and to, at the same time, get her little side project out of the White Township plant out into the Congo and under more of her direct control, which would be interesting to see in season four. Besides the cobalt mines that have been talked about ad nauseum within the subreddits and discussions about Mr. Robot, why exactly the Congo? Well, China has, you know, in the real world, gone into the Congo and has significant influences and very much doing their own form. I guess you could say, I don't know if colonialism is the apt word for the 21st century, but serious economic entanglement to where they have control of the Congo in much of the sense, and trying to go into the continent of Africa more so aggressively than the European countries or America or something, or the West, if you will. Why the Congo, really? Why did she needed to move it out? That they need to explain that in season four. Understand why, how it's being moved, and that she needs it to get done. But why does it need to be moved? Why specifically in the location it's being moved to? But I just wanted to kind of point that out and stuff like that. And I fundamentally believe, and this was actually kind of written before season three kicked off, that Sam Vincent Mel, with using the Fight Club template and having Elliot dealing and the members of F Society and those who remain of F Society, which right now is Elliot and Darlene, dealing with the ethical consequences, the real world consequences, the death and destruction that they have caused, and the death of personal people in their lives as a result of their revolutionary actions, realizing a lot of it was just bunk. Particularly, I don't think Darlene is aware of this, but Elliot knows this through his Mr. Robot personality. Philip Price stating that all this was only happening because he, a member of the 1%, allowed it, because it allowed for a certain alignments that were going to occur anyways, for having Dark Army taking his concept and taking it to his logical conclusion. And I think that's why, while some people didn't like the way season three ended, it ended the way it did, because that is the end of the, I guess you could say, the ethical dilemma, the ethical struggle that Elliot has had with the consequences of what he's doing, which you don't see in Fight Club. You don't see the ethical consequences, or even the struggle of having this particular revolution happen, as you do in Fight Club. Granted, the narrator did try to stop Tyler Durden for the purpose of getting control of his personality, really, so it's more selfish, saving his girl, Marla, another selfish reason, and three, not really wanting to have people die. Not really to stop the financial collapse or anything like that, but he didn't want people dying. But the buildings were empty, so nobody was dying. So some aspect of him knew that. So the whole purpose of his struggle with Tyra Durden was just control of the primary person, if you will, and not really stopping the financial collapse of an entire society, which was what would have happened if all those buildings, which they did collapse, going to zero credit, if you will. And given the fact that they were primarily in the States, but it was hinted at but not shown in Fight Club, that Fight Club was a global thing, this could have easily been going on in different cities. So I guess it's assumed on the part of the audience that this was happening everywhere. Anywhere where there's credit card or banking infrastructure, these buildings were coming down. These servers, these records were disappearing, if you will. So I will have a link in the show notes to Josh H., who does the site of On Pirate Satellite. He does other reviews of other different television shows. I encourage you to read it. He has really great blogs. I've been following him for a while now. I would say years, even before Mr. Robot started. He started doing the Mr. Robot reviews. But I have a link to his stuff. He's a great commentator on the Mr. Robot show and the Mr. Robot subreddit, and through his own personal blogs that he posts through Medium. So I think now that with the way season three ended, with the Dark Army, you know, basically getting away, Philip Price getting away, even though he has to resign as president, Angela getting away with it, finding out Philip Price is her father, Elliot and Darlene getting out of the clutches of the Dark Army, Dom now in the clutches of the Dark Army, whom I think, still keeping with the horror aspect of season three, she's a pod person. She's not the Dom that we have known and loved, and we're going to see that in season four, where she's been, in essence, completely replaced because of the things that she's going to be asked to do on behalf of the Dark Army, or her family is going to get wiped out. Even with the reversal of the decryptions of the electronic files of E-Corp, which will restore some sense of order to, for the most part, is not going to really change anything as far as the overall economic and ethical problems that Elliot is going to be facing, or society in general that he's part of is facing. And I think that's why season three ended the way it did, because even though he reversed the hack and changed things and tried to restore order, you know, it might have been a backup plan, as Mr. Robot and Elliot were talking about, you know, a potential possibility if things don't really work out and go sideways, they can still kind of undo the damage, mitigate it, if you will, and not really totally fuck people over. I think that's why we're going to go into a completely different direction and phase for this season four, and if the rumors are true, season five, and there's two more seasons, it's going to be something completely different. Because I think for as far as Sam Ismail's story arc or storytelling, as far as the repudiation of the concept of not the lack of ethical consequences and showing it in Fight Club, he's resolved that story arc within himself through this show in the first three seasons. And now I think what we're going to see here, because again, as I stated in my first review of Back to the Future Part 2, there are no fairy tales here. This is not a fairy tale. It's based really in the real world, in a sense, and in its governance. And there's not going to be any kind of happy ending. And so we're going to see, or I guess you can say, a reemergence of this scrappy band of rebels going against the big bad. But I think it's going to be more organized and more deliberate, and it's not going to be necessarily an ad hoc revolutionary, but more of the large scale, old school, now I say old school, but militaristic, organized societal revolutions, where you have a larger, much larger, more organized group taking down a bigger bad. I would say it akin to maybe the American Revolution, which was overthrowing the British rule in the States. There's another app. I don't want to keep it in the West. I guess that even some sense, the movement in, Mao Zedong, the communist ruler, his attack against the Socialist Party. Because most people don't realize in China there was a civil war going on, as well as the Japanese invading in World War II. His organized fight against the Socialists, as well as fighting the Japanese to overthrow their influence, in that sense. Any kind of long-scale, successful revolutionary act, the Bolsheviks in Russia, the efforts by various allies, as well as internal movements within World War II against Nazi Germany, or even against the Japanese government. You know, look at Vietnam, look at a lot of the southeastern countries that were fighting against Japan, Korea, for example. Those type of organizations that were eventually successful because there was a larger purpose. It was like us, all of us, against them. And I think you might begin to see that in season four. Again, it's much speculation on my part, because I really don't know where they kind of painted themselves in the corner with the reiteration of the 1% of the 1%, this mantra where, are we truly following a crazy person, or has the crazy person learned? Because, you know, what is the adage? Repeating the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is insanity. Are we going to see a more organized and actual set of tone, as Philip Price stated to the Mr. Robot personality of Elliot? You know, where are your followers? What revolution are you leading? You know, leaders set agendas. And I think we're going to start seeing some agenda setting on the part of Elliot, and to some extent, if, you know, how much Mr. Robot plays in season four, setting of an agenda that is going to go after White Rose and Philip Price and the rest of the 1% infrastructure. And the last bit, because, like I said, most people don't realize Fight Club's a satire. I think also, I don't think people realize that in some extent, Mr. Robot is a satire, a very dark satire of our times, because of all the things that have gone on within the last, I would say, since 9/11, really, almost 20 years of the different chaos and activities and, you know, revolutions like the Arab Spring, the Purple Revolution, the economic upheaval, the collapse, if you will, that occurred between 2007 and 2009, but still really, if you think about it, still really being felt by many Americans. They still, you know, just look at the millennial generation. There's a good chunk of them that are not in the economic place that they potentially are projected should be. And all the shifting, you know, Trump and all that stuff, and the shifting dynamics that are going on in the globe is a really dark satire of what was really current in real time, which is very amusing, because if you think about it, if Sam Esmail was very much inspired not only by all his film heroes, but what was going on with the Arab Spring, well, one of the key factors of why the Arab Spring was so successful in its launch was of Twitter, the microblogging site that allows you to basically communicate in real time to the world in almost an instantaneous fashion with 140 characters. In essence, Mr. Robot, in a sense, is real-timing satire of these episodes, communicating to us in these 45-minute chunks of what our world looks like. And I think that's a very genius move. I think that's why the show is very engaging. I think it's why it has a lot of the intellectual depth that it does, and why you can have these kind of debates about the different ethical dilemmas and the hidden truths, if you will, within the show, and finding the different nuances and layers within the series is in itself, because it resonates so much to what is occurring, because it's based on truth. It's not so fictional that it's a fantastical viewpoint of the world where you're realizing you're watching a fantasy like Star Wars or even Marvel to some extent, but you can gravitate towards the show and to the various characters because there's a realness to them, because it seems like they're based off of real people. It seems like you're watching a true life story be enacted before your eyes. So that's pretty much what I all have to say about the Fight Club influence. It was obvious that influence was, you know, a bit of an homage, a story launching point for Sam Esmail to tell about the ethical consequences of when you collapse an economy and how to deal with it. It's something that a lot of these different films or television or books don't really get into because it's very messy. And that's what makes the show Mr. Robot so engaging, is because it deals with this messiness, if you will, and which makes it very refreshing, because you haven't really seen that so much in media of dealing with consequences, if you will, and taking that narrative approach. But overall, I would recommend watching Fight Club. I think it will give you a kind of a sense of clarity if you haven't seen the film itself. Or maybe rewatching it and seeing, like, oh, it's not quite what I remember it. If you were a person who might have taken the movie a bit literally and not seen it through the eyes of comedy or satire, if you will. So that's it for this show. And thank you very much for listening. And until next time, I'm logging off.
This has been a Hiroshi Shine Space Odyssey Network production.